Okay, so now we have 90 minutes, and we will take a little break after 45 minutes, okay? We'll have a couple of minutes break. And please call it, because I will forget. All right, okay, so what are we doing? I will briefly summarize what we were doing. So we have a local quantum system, which means that Hilbert spaces are the tensor product of degrees of freedom in different regions. And in particular, we are concerned with two different regions, A and B, with the graph distance dAB. And our Hamiltonian is a local Hamiltonian, which means it's the sum of local Hermitian operators, and it is constant. It's not a time-dependent Hamiltonian. And to it, it's associated a unitary evolution operator, e to the minus iht, and operators evolved in the Heisenberg picture as u dagger au. And we are interested in the commutator between two operators that have support on different regions A and B, okay? And we call this function f of t the commutator, with where A is dependent on time and B is not, okay? Why? Okay, so let me preempt a question. Maybe you can try to answer. Why this object is not interesting?
Because they are like A and B, AB.
Yeah, I don't know if I heard correctly, but because these, we know this can be written in this way. Is this what you said, right? Mm-hmm. And then you see that if they do not commute at time zero, they never commute. Yeah. Or if they commute at time zero, actually, if they commute at time zero, they always commute. So there is nothing interesting in the equal time commutators. If there is some signaling properties, must be an object of this type. And then we will show it explicitly. So our strategy was to find the bound for f of t. And to do that, we first took the first derivative. And we were able by, since the, okay, so let me do the first passage. The first passage is that you have I and then the commutator with the Hamiltonian of A of t, B. Okay, and our reason, and H is this. And we showed that those terms that have no overlap with A will not contribute anyway, right? So we can restrict this sum only to the X1 in Z1. And now we have the commutator between phi x1, a t, b. Okay, so what I want to retain is the definition of z1 here, is the subsets in lambda such that x intersect with a is non-null. And then using basically Jacobi identity, we manipulated this expression and we wrote it as I, the sum over x1 in z1 of, let me open a large parenthesis, the commutator with the phi x1 of t commuted with A of T B plus the commutator of A of T with B phi x1 of T. Okay, so I'm summarizing what I started doing earlier. And we recognize that this is L, some linear operator acting on F, because we see F here. And this is something else that I can call G. And remember, the solution of this differential equation can be written as F of T is equal gamma T. So gamma T is a unitary map because it's the solution of the homogeneous equation of this term, where we recognize that the sum of these terms is a Hamiltonian. Therefore, the solution of this differential equation is like this, is, must be a unitary map. So this is fundamental. So we everything has this unitary map in front, and then we have f the time 0, and plus we have the particular solution that is obtained by a variation of parameters. And notice that I have to integrate between some new time variable to t, and this gives us the t dependence. Okay. Now, because we are looking, what we are looking is for a bound on the norm of f of t. Okay, so we argued that the bound on f of t, an upper bound, is the norm of f of 0 plus the integral of the norm of gs1 in ds1. Okay. So this is what we want to do now. So notice that f of 0, remark. Notice that f of 0 is just a commutator b, right? And this is 0 unless A and B have a non-null intersection, which means that this distance is 0. Okay? So remember this. This term is 0 unless already A and B have a non-null intersection. Okay. So now let's try to bound GS1, I mean this term, okay? So this term is what? Is the integral between 0 and t of this object, okay? So now let me find bounds to these things. Okay, so I have the integral. So as you can see, this is a commutator with A of t of another commutator. What is a generic bound for the commutator of two operators x and y? A bound that is always good. We could do it here too, right?
Hmm?
the product of the norm times the constant?
Something about the product of the norm is actually 2 times the product of the norms. So I could have done it from the beginning. I could have said that f of t is upper bounded by 2ab. This is a true statement. It's a very true statement and very useless. I'm saying that the norm of this commutator is definitely upper bounded by this number, but this number is not particularly small. It can be anything you want. Whereas, remember, what is our goal? We want to show that there is a tight upper bound, that it is a small number. So if we do it from the beginning at this level, we don't go anywhere, okay? But it is, these type of bounds are still true. So if I do it here, I can upper bound with the 2, the norm of A of t, the norm of the other commutator. So I can put a 2, the norm of A of t. And what is the norm of A of t like? Who said that?
A.
A. Good. Why? Because U is norm-preserving. Okay. So we have this. And now we have finally the norm of the commutator between B and phi x1 of S1 in DS1. Remember that I'm considering this G operator at the time S1. Good. Okay, so this is very neat. And now you see that the next step is to bound this object, this commutator. But now you see that this commutator has something in common with what we were doing before, right? Before, I was trying to find an upper bound between A that is evolved in time and B. Now it's another operator, phi x1, that is evolved in time and B. So I can try to use the same technique. So let me define a function f1 or the variable s1 that I define as the commutator b phi x1 of the variable s1. So now let me play the same game I played for f. Let me take the first derivative. Okay. So let me be boring.
Sorry, I was thinking x1.
Yeah.
X1 is the, oh, I see. X1 is the same one. Oh.
This is phi x1.
I see. Sorry, yes.
Right? Because it's phi x1 here.
Yes.
Okay. So, look, here I'm just bounding this term, yeah. Right? In the end, whatever I find in the end, I have to plug it back here, okay?
Yes.
So we will collect all the terms. Okay, but so as part of this bound, we have the norm of this commutator. And now it's interesting that the norm of this commutator has the same structure as before. So I can try to play this game again, right? So I take the first derivative of this function, and this would be equal to I H this commutator. Right? And remember that again H is the sum of all over all the x's of phi x. Okay.
Is it where did the sum, okay, so we're summing over x now, but are we summing over x everywhere?
Are there.
So okay, let me go back. You agree that when I take the derivative, I have this? Okay. Now what is h? H is this. So I'm just substituting. Okay. And in fact, I can do a bit better than this. I can actually, because B does not depend on time, I can do a bit better than this. I can just differentiating the time dependent part. So I can actually write it like this. It's exactly what I did before when I differentiated a of t b. Okay, again, this Hamiltonian commutes with u. So now I can define u at the time s1. So again, I can extract the u terms from here and then put them back. Okay. And this time, we realize that this commutator would be zero unless this axis have a non-null overlap with x1. So we restrict the sum to those axes that are subset of lambda such that x intersect x1 is different from the null set, provided that x1 is in z1, right, under this condition. So let me call this set z2. So you agree that this is the sum on x2 in a z2 only. Okay, we like that. And now by playing the Jacobi identity, I can write this thing as I times the sum. So when I write sum of x2, you understand it means that x2 is in z2 of phi x2 of s1 commutator phi x1 of s1 b plus another commutator that is phi x1 s1 with the commutator of b phi x2 of s1, closed commutator, closed parenthesis. Okay. And as you can see here, we have f1. It's actually minus f1, but doesn't matter. Right? In fact, I can write all this. Okay, so let me go to the next blackboard. So I can write f1 over s1 as I the sum over x2.
So it should be minus I. There is a minus sign from Jacobi, from the Jacobi identity.
Are you sure there is a minus sign?
So you can see.
I think I'm right. However,
doesn't matter,
right? We will always put everything in norm, and use a triangle inequality. We can check later if I. So let's pretend that I actually got it right with the signs. And so if I call that, because the commutator is minus F1, and then I swap these terms, I can write here F1, comma, F1, comma, phi x2 of S1, right? Plus this other term, which is phi x1 of S1, commutator OB with the phi of x2 at S1. Okay, good. Okay, so now as you can see, this is again, this was phi prime. This was phi prime. This was the derivative. This is again a linear differential equation in which this part is the evolution with the Hamiltonian. So this means that the homogeneous part will be a unitary map. So by doing exactly what I did before, I can write a bound on F1 as, so this will be smaller of equal of the sum over all x2s. And then I will have a bound of this plus, okay, this thing. So oh yes. F1 at the time 0, right? Because this is the homogeneous part. This would be gamma at S of S1 of phi 1 of 0. And the norm of that is just the norm of F1 of 0. OK. Plus, and now we have to integrate from 0 to S1 some new variable that I will call S2. And this new variable, I am integrating this object, right? So I will have this norm, phi x1 of s1. Then I have a 2. And then I have the norm of this object that I'm integrating, b phi of x2 s2.
And so
first of all, this is S2, right? Because this is the inhomogeneous part, and I forgot this sum, right? There is this sum here.
We summed all the phis to get the Hamiltonian.
That's right. So when that gives me. This term is a Hamiltonian in this term, but here I have I have to distribute the sum here too. So I have this sum over x2 here. Okay.
And do you have the sum in the first term?
And I do not have the sum on the first term. So I got them mixed up. Thank you. That's right, because here is where we got the Hamiltonian.
Already defined in the linear operator L.
The linear operator L is the commutation of F1 with H, with this new H, with this H2. Okay, so now let's collect the terms. So notice that this term, F1 of 0, is 0. So what is F1 of 0? Is F1 commuted with, F1 of 0,
what is f1? Is b commuted with phi x1 at the time 0? So it is 0 unless x1 has a non-null intersection with b. Okay, you see? So we need these terms to have some specific topology in order to give a non-zero contribution. Okay. I have everything. Yes. Okay. Okay. So now let's put together all the terms. Let's see. So f of t is smaller or equal than the norm of f of 0, which is 2ab with the condition, right? The condition is that a has a non-null intersection with b. So let me call this condition, so a function that is 0 is 1 if there is a non-null intersection with b, and 0 otherwise, let me call it sigma 0. Okay, so let me define it. Sigma 0 is 0 for a intersection with b and 1 when the intersection is non-null. Okay, so we have that, and then we have.
So you mean that if A and B are not intersected, they are the FT is zero?
No. Okay. So you see, we saw, remark, the commutator between A and B.
Yes.
If they are disjoint, is zero. Right.
But FT is not zero.
Yeah, f of 0.
I mean, ft is not 0 in general, but sigma 0 is 0 in general.
So, okay. We have the norm of f of t, right?
Yes.
This is upper bounded by the norm of f of 0.
Plus something.
Plus other stuff. So I'm writing the first term.
Oh.
The first term is upper bounded by this.
Yes, yes. That.
Okay. So let me call this the zero order term.
Oh, okay. Oh.
Okay. So this is the zero order term. Now I will add more terms. Okay. Now we have the integral between 0 and t of this GS. Okay.
Sorry, the sigma zero, is it switch? It's not intersecting and intersecting.
Huh?
The requirements are backwards of what you have on the top. When A and B are not intersecting, it's zero.
When A and B are not intersecting,
well, just that's
is zero.
I think that's different than what you wrote up there, but I'm not
sure.
Oh, unless.
Unless.
Okay.
Unless it's okay. Okay. Okay, so where am I? Okay. So remember that we have, okay, so I did do a mistake though, because here this is smaller than this plus the integral, but I forgot that I'm summing over all the x1. So okay, now we're good. Okay. Okay. So here I have a sigma of x1 over all the x1s. And we have 2a Okay. And then we have this new norm, right? Okay.
That sum you just added, wasn't it included in the definition of G?
Oh no, I called G just the term. I called the G just the term. Because I want to keep it explicit. But if I include it in the definition of G, then you know, then here I will have to put the sum.
Yes.
So we also need it in the definition of F of T, like the second line?
That's right. So so let me do this because it requires less effort. Let me define it with the sum included, and then what it means is that when I collect all the here, I will have the sum over x1. Okay. So we have, so let me copy it. We have 2 a norm of a integral between 0 and t, the sum over x1. Okay. And now I have 2 terms, right? Because the first term will be this one, f1, 0, which is the commutator between F10 is the commutator between B and phi X1. So let me put it. I upper bound it by 2. B phi X1 at the time S1, but we know that when we take the norm, we don't care about time, okay? So every time I take a norm, then I can erase time. But I have a condition, right? I have a condition that X1 must have a non-null intersection with B this time. And this condition, I call it sigma 1. Okay, so this is, let me call it sigma f is 0 unless phi x1 and b are different, do intersect. So they must intersect in order to have 1. So they're intersecting, you get 1. So let me put here this condition, sigma f, plus 2a, this integral, sigma x1, this term, right? Okay, plus 2a, the integral between 0 and t, sigma x1, and now I have this object, which is the integral between 0 and s1, ds2, 2, now we have the norm of phi x1, and now the commutator between b and phi x2. Okay. Do you agree that this is our total bound so far?
Sorry, what do you mean by a? A is an operator. You have 2a, right? A when a intersect b, you see a as the edges, but then you are seeing a also the operator.
Yeah. So I excuse myself for this notation at the beginning. I said that a and b are operators on with supports on ha and ab, and of course when I
secret ha, yes.
Now you agree.
So when you write A in a set B, secretly is A.
I'm talking about the sets. Okay. The sets. So I, you know, in the notes, I will make sure that these A's actually have hats. But these are sets.
I see.
These are the sets on which the corresponding Hilbert spaces have a support. Yeah.
The sum over X2 missing.
The sum over X2, let me see where it is. It's here. Thank you.
We could have a different symbol for the indicator functions about the intersections because, like, some sigma and that sigma.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Indicator functions depend on the set X1. So
yeah. Let me call it theta F, theta 0. Okay.
The theta f is dependent upon x1 and it appears inside the sum. So maybe we could have a theta subscript x1.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. But now you understand, now in the next passage you understand why I wanted to call it f. Okay. Because, so look what we have here. We have at the zero order, 2ab, plus at the second order, we have 2ab times something. Okay? At the third order, we have, sorry, at the second order, this is zero first, second order, we have a 2a. We still need to make a bound here, right? And you see that now this time, is the commutator between B and phi. And I will have, this is at the time S2. And I will play the game again. And when I play the game again, I get again the norm of B. So let's say that I play this game N times. Okay? So every time I can bound, I can bound the k term at the time sk by the bound of fk at the time zero plus the integral between zero and the time sk in the variable dsk plus one. And what I get two, the norm of phi xk, and then the sum over dxk plus 1, the next ones, where I have the bound, the norm of the commutator between b and phi xk plus 1 at sk plus 1, right? You know, I can iterate, so I can do it as many times as I want. Okay. So what happens when I put all these terms together? So as you can, as I was saying, every time you get a new indicator function that tells you, okay, so at the next order, what I will have to, what will happen is that these objects will have to not commute with the previous ones. And now it will be these ones that have to not commute with B. So in the end, and look also what we have. Here we have the sum over, we have the sum over no axis at the zero order. First order, we have the sum over x1, and that's it. Second order, we have the sum over x1 and x2. And then I will have sum over x1, x2, x3. So you see that we will have a sum over x1, x2, up to xn, subject to these rules that A intersect B, sorry, that x1
intersect A is different from the null set, that xi intersect xi plus 1 is different from the null set. And finally, that xn intersect b is different from the null set. Okay, so I have that my f of t is smaller than the sum of all these terms. Let me call the index of this term n. And I do it infinite times. Okay? And what do I have? Yeah, I have the sum over all these x1, xn. And every time I have 2ab. So this can be collected, right? Then at every order, notice that I gain a 2. You see, at every order, I have a new multiplicative 2, which comes from upper bounding the next commutator. You see, at the zero order, we have just 2ab. In the first order, we have 2ab times 2. In the next order, we have 2ab, then we have that 2 and the next 2. So here I will get 2 to the n. Okay. Then I have all these integrals, right? 0 t in ds1, 0 s1 ds2, up to 0 s n dsn minus 1 dsn. Right? Okay. What else do I have? I have the product of all these phi's. Right? I have phi x1, phi xn. You see, this is what happens when I sum all the terms together. Questions before I go ahead? I want this to be crystal clear.
I have one question. Is it A is belongs to x1 or A in x1? Do we need to exclude A from x1?
So, A is basically A is x0, is the zero term.
Yeah, I mean, this x0 to xn, they are strictly, how to say, include each other. Or, I mean, do we need to exclude A from x1? Because then we may have infinite loops.
I'm not sure I understand the question. So what I'm saying is that if x1 does not intersect with A, you know, then there will be no, the commutator will be always exactly zero.
Yes, so what I'm saying is we know that A intersects of itself. So A belongs to x1, right?
No, A, think of this. A is the set x0, if you want.
Yes.
And you need x0 and x1 to have a non-null intersection in order for this commutator to not be identically zero.
Yes.
So, and in the end, this means that this sum is over all the x1, x2, and xn with these conditions. The x1 must have a non-null intersection with A. The x2 must have a non-null intersection with x1, as we saw. And the xn must have a non-null intersection with b. So this is a constraint over all these x1, xn.
Yes, what I mean that you need to exclude a from x1. Because by our now present definition, the Z1 include, we have A in Z1 or A X1.
Sorry, I am.
I mean, A is a one kind of S1.
It could be X1. You could take X1.
Yeah, if we take A to be X1, then we may have infinite loops from A to B. We need to exclude this possibility of infinite loop.
If
we already take N to infinite.
If we include the infinite loop, it's a nonsense to.
But A is just an operator, it's not part of the Hamiltonian. A is an operator with the...
I mean, A is a site, not operator.
Yeah, as a site, okay.
So
where
the order of A with itself is zero, but despite that it is part of the set X1. And we want to exclude all commutators which have a zero commutator from X1. But so, I mean...
If so, you're asking the question, what happens if A is included in X1?
Yes.
I think that's okay. A can be included in X1.
Yes. Then we have an infinite loop. Because we can always go into A to A to A to A to A, and then goes out A.
That's fine. That's fine. I'm not denying that, but this doesn't change this formula.
Yes, this okay.
Okay, yeah. So it's fine. Okay, so we are here, okay? And remember, this sum is subject to this constraint. Okay, so now let's play a little bit. So first of all, what is, look, this is A, this is B, and we are thinking, so let's take one choice of x1, xn that obeys our constraints. So let me show it to you. So it's something like this. Right? As you can see, this is a path with the n steps between A and B. And here we are summing over all the paths with n steps from A to B. So I will so that we remember this. This is the sum over all the paths with n steps from A to B. Okay. So. So this is, now let me use smaller or equal. Here I have the sum of every n. Okay. Then we have 2ab that I can put at the beginning. B. Okay. Then I have 2 to the n. Okay. Now you see, these objects that were the time evolved ones, but they took the norm, and the norm is the unitary evolution is norm preserving, so they do not actually depend on these numbers from the variables S1, Sn. And each of them, where is it? It's where did I write it? Ah, I didn't write it this time. But remember, these are bounded operators. So each of all of them, we have one quantity to bind them all. It's H, remember? So each of them is smaller than H. So I can upper bound by H to the n. OK. Now we have this empty integral. That we still need to integrate, and we want to upper bound. So you all have taken quantum field theory, so you recognize this type of nested integral. right? That I integrate this variable, and then this variable becomes the next one. What where does this appear? In the Dyson series.
Yes.
Right? Dyson series. You know that this is equal to 1 over the number of, so this is n factorial, and then you integrate always in the same variable n times. And you also know that, and therefore, I can bound each of these integrals, obviously, by t, because I'm integrating the function 1. So this is t to the n over n factorial. OK, so here we have 2ab, and then we have the sum over all the paths, nab. And then I have the sum over n. And then we have 2n hn t to the n over n factorial. So you see that there is an exponential that wants to be born. It really wants to appear, right? So let's deliver it. The only thing that is troubling us is this number. Notice that this is now just a number, right? Because these numbers do not depend on which path. That's why we did all these bounds, that we bounded every path with the same quantity. So this is simply the number of paths between A and B. OK, so let me bound this thing. So let me do it here. Okay, and okay, let me do it now, then we take a break. Okay, so these are paths with n steps, right? N steps. In each of these steps, how much distance on the graph I cover? Look up. Look up, but I didn't write it. In n step, so in one step, so okay. So we had these conditions. In one step, I can connect sides that are at the distance r. In n steps, I can connect the distance that is at the distance n r. So you see that if d, ab, is greater than nr, there is no path from a to b. And I'm only summing on the paths from a to b. OK. So in the case of d and b greater than nr, this number, sum pnab, is actually 0. And now let me do something naive, silly. But if this is 0, so it's smaller than any number c, where c is greater than 0. OK, so far so good. But if dab is smaller than nr, then I have many paths, okay? So in this case, let's see how we can bound it. These are all the paths with n steps between a and b. Do you agree that this is a subset of all the paths with n steps? Right? So I have another path with n steps that leads nowhere. And in this subset are included those that connect A and B. So I can do a very crude bound. It's smaller than the number of paths of n steps regardless whether they connect A and B. Okay, now using this, at most, X as volume sigma, in how many ways I can have axes that intersect? And I am using n of them. Sigma to the n. Right? Because every pair can intersect in at most in sigma ways. So this is upper bounded by sigma to the n. Okay. Now, I can furtherly upper bound if I multiply sigma n by any number greater than 1. Right? Okay. And as a number greater than 1, I will choose e to the alpha nr minus dab with alpha greater than 1. For every value of this parameter alpha, this is a number greater than 1. Remember that dab is smaller than nr. So I can upper bound it like this. Now, is this number greater than 0 anyway, even when nr is smaller than dab? Yes, right? This is the exponential. So this is also c. So regardless of whether dab is greater or smaller than nr, this number bounds our quantity. Okay. So this is smaller than 2ab, and then we have the sum over n of sigma n, 2 to the n, h to the n, t to the n, over n factorial, and now we have e to the alpha nr minus dab. Okay, we're almost done. So you see now I can write this as 2ab, the sum over n. So I have sigma 2ht e to the alpha r over n to the power n over n factorial times e to the minus alpha dab. And now this does not depend on n. Yes?
I have a question on this step where we bound the sum of all the paths of says n by sigma to the power n.
Yeah.
I have the thing that I could choose, if I have a huge set, even if I can only choose sigma 1, I have a lot of ways of taking. If sigma is the size of one,
mm-hmm.
one step,
is the maximum size possible?
Yeah, but I can take it anywhere in my huge set of sites. I could would be straight, but I could go in every direction if I have a lot of directions.
So we need to start from A, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And in how many ways can I choose X that overlaps with A? Don't you agree that there are?
Like I could take one element of A and anything around, it would intersect, but.
Okay, so fair enough. So this would be equal to the volume of A times at most the volume of X.
Yeah, but I have a lot of ways to choose X.
No, you don't have a lot of ways to choose X. You have at most sigma ways of choosing X.
I would say I have...
For every point of A, so let's say that A is just a point, okay? Well, you know, the if X contains sigma sites, then there are the most sigma ways of choosing X.
Well, I'm just picturing if I'm taking A as a set, I take one point of A and I take another point in my whole subset or another one, it's different paths if I'm going from,
No, so the paths have an order, right? From A, you can only go to, must intersect with X1.
Yeah, but X1 doesn't need to be jointed. I mean, I could take, do I need?
X1 cannot be longer than capital R. But still, no matter how long it is, it only contains at most sigma sites. So this is just how in how many ways I can construct a path.
It's not the thing that if I have big N points in my universe, and if I could choose sigma among this N, I would have a lot of different paths. And the restriction will also depend on the on R. If I have
okay, so let's make a path of length one, okay? Please.
Yeah.
Okay, so we just want to know in how many ways I can overlap X with A. Okay, and A is a site. Just a site.
Okay, if I can choose, say a thing of size two, I could take the site this one and the size here, or the site here, 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 the site here. All these choices give me a different path, but give me, it's a different X1. I have A is my point.
Yeah.
I say I want to intersect. I authorize sigma to be two or three. I can take 2 points. So X1 is one point, which is all A. And then I can take the neighbor here, the neighbor here, the neighbor here, the neighbor here, the neighbor here. The side here, the side here.
No, I know, but then they do not have diameter R.
Okay, but then this should appear in my condition also, maybe, no? Or, like, this seems to depend only on sigma, but it depends also on R. Seems to depend on R.
I'm actually not sure. So let me think. Okay. So let's say you have x1 and x1 plus 1 and x2. So I'm not really sure what you mean when you say so I have to intersect one of these points, and there are at most sigma ways of intersecting it.
Yeah. So then for each choice of where I intersect.
Yes, sure. Okay, but to intersect X1, there are only sigma ways of intersecting it. Then, okay, so now we only have sigma, right? Now let's say in how many ways I can intersect X2. It will be sigma times sigma, right? So I don't see any way around that. I think it's sigma to the n. we can discuss this more, okay? Okay, so anyway, here you finally have an exponential. Okay, so we have shown that our commutator ATB in norm is upper bounded by 2AB, and then we have an exponential. Okay, let me see what is this exponential. This is e 2. Okay, so look at this number, 2h sigma e to the alpha r, which has the dimensions of an energy, which is one of the inverse of time. And let me call this v. One of the inverse of time is also a velocity on a graph, right? Because distances are pure numbers. Okay, so this has the dimensions of a speed. So the exponential here is e to the vt minus alpha dab. So let me put alpha here. I have d over alpha t minus dab. In fact, let me just put alpha here. Okay. Let me put alpha in the definition of v. Okay. Good. So we are done. We've proven the Lib-Robinson bounds. What do they say? They say that if the distance AB, you see, VT minus DAB is a light cone, is a light cone structure. If DAB is larger than VT, then the norm of this commutator is exponentially small. So in one sense, this emergent light cone is fuzzy because it's not sharp. Because if A is here and B is here, okay, so actually I have a non-vanishing commutator between A at the time t and B. However, this signal, let me call it signal, I will actually show that it's actually a signal, is exponentially small. Okay? So this means that I can violate my light cone, my Lorentz invariance only very close to the light cone. But then after that, I don't see any difference. It's, you know, it's exponentially small. No matter what experiment, I cannot make. So an interesting question is, how large is this fuzziness? And now we see that we have a limitation due to the fact that we're on a graph, right? There is no length scale here. So we, in order to have a length scale and make length a dimensionful quantity, we need to immerse our graph in real space. In this case, so the distances L are equal d times A, where A is a lattice spacing. And now this is a length. Now this has the dimensions of a length. Okay? Could be the Planck scale. It could be something that says, oh, the minimum distance that exists in nature. But maybe there is no minimum distance, right? We don't know. A can be, as far as we know, when we believe in quantum field theory, we are saying that we can take A to zero. Okay, so now let's plug this thing in our result. Okay, so we have, this is equal to 2AB. Now we have E. Okay, So now I can call V tilde a quantity that is like let me my V, this is the Lieb-Robinson speed in the graph distance as the dimensions of a graph distance, which is a number, over t, which means L over AT. So this has the dimension of a real speed over A. Okay? So let's plug this here. So we will have e to the alpha. So v becomes v tilde over a. Then we have t. And minus dab, dab is l over a. So I can put a here. So a is this price that we're paying for being on a lattice. So you see that being on a lattice means that actually our theory is local, but not very, very, very local. In what sense? If I have a degree of freedom here, so, okay, I, and this is another degree of freedom, j, and they are at one lattice distance, a, every interacting theory contains the axes that are at least two body, right? So this means that we are allowing 2 degrees of freedom to interact. We have action at the distance, right? They are at distance a, and we put in the Hamiltonian a non-local term. For our theory to be really local, this only works in the limit of a going to zero. So what I'm saying is that in our Hamiltonian, we are saying, if I put a two-body term between nearest neighbors, I'm saying that two objects that are at the distance a in real space interact immediately. I don't need time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So in this sense, I am I'm not very local. I'm local over large distances, but I'm not local on short distances. So if I want to take my locality really seriously, things should only interact with their immediate neighborhood. And the immediate neighborhood means that A goes to zero. Right? I have to do some sort of continuum theory. And if I take the limit of A going to zero here, you see that this becomes sharp. Right? As soon as I'm away from the light cone, this becomes e to the minus infinity. So this light cone is actually sharp in real space. It is not sharp on a lattice only because on a lattice we have actually violate the microlocality. But in real space, in a continuous space, it's actually sharp. So you see that if it is true that this commutator means that we cannot send the signals, which I just waved my hands, right? I didn't actually prove. But if that is true, means that you cannot send signals away from the from this emergent light cone, even though we didn't put any Lorentz invariants. So this light cone is emergent. Okay, so this is one of the beautiful things about this type of tools and methods. Okay, so I'll take your question, then we take a break, and I'll show you the no signaling thing. Okay? Yeah, what's your question?
This must be used in quantum gravity, probably, right? Or some kind of ideas where there, I have graph structures and the real life has a gap A that is more than zero. Or, I mean, here, if we're in a lattice or something, you know there are small scales, you can say, oh, the A is yeah, we could.
Yeah.
Zero, but
okay.
Zero,
so this is something that shows, and there are many other examples that symmetries, at least some symmetries, so the light cone, the Lorentz invariance, or U1, or other also theories like SO3. Can be emergent from an underlying structure that does not have this symmetry. Because you see, I didn't impose any light cone structure here. So this is the take-home message, that maybe they're not fundamental. Maybe if I go below the lattice structure, then I see a violation. Now, the point is, you know, maybe you cannot go there. Right? Maybe because the energy is too high. So within our experimental capabilities, it could be the same. OK. Now, the question about quantum gravity is a much harder nut to crack. Because here, this is a theory in quantum mechanics. Right, I used ordinary quantum mechanics. I have a Hamiltonian, and this defines time. Okay, so there is nothing here that shows that, you know, I can have those effects like in general relativity, in which I don't know time bends or there are different. You know, you don't always have a foliation that is. Global foliation, right? I already defined what is time because I gave an Hamiltonian. So quantum gravity is more complicated than that. And actually, from the little I understand, the problem of time is where all this quantization procedure becomes complicated because your theory becomes just a constraint because H of psi must be zero. Otherwise, it would not be diffeomorphism invariant, right? Because the time evolution would change things. Yeah.
So I don't quite understand why we are having a light cone structure despite the fact that we are treating time as a parameter like we do in quantum mechanics. Like, you don't have anything like four vectors that's happening over here. So how come we are getting light cone?
Yeah, so that's why it is emergent. So it's... emergent means that you have a feature that comes from, you know, the many body global interplay of all these things, and you didn't put it from the beginning.
Yeah, but we are not really respecting relativity if we are taking time to be some parameter which we know, like, absolutely, right?
Sorry, I'm lost. I didn't understand the question.
Like, so what are the assumptions that we are making when we start writing the Hamiltonian? We don't say anything about the symmetries of the problem, and we don't say anything about causality. So how come, like, there should be some assumption that we respect at the start, which gives us this?
No, the causal structure is indeed emergent. The only thing that you put from the beginning is the locality of the Hamiltonian. So this means that you do not have instantaneous interactions between objects that are a distance greater than capital R. But, you know, in spite of that, because of the Schrödinger equation, actually there is at every time there is a small influence, no matter what is the distance, is what happens when you exponentiate this operator, because now the support is everywhere. However, you know, the very nice idea was to say somehow this support vanishes outside of the light cone. Well, now you can all feel a bit cheated on, because all we proved is that this commutator is small. So what does this commutator have anything to do with the support of the operators or with the signaling? It's a doubt that I have to show you that this is in, you know, that this thing implies the rest. But yeah, so to the extent that we believe this statement, yeah, I mean, it's a very remarkable fact, because, and notice also that this is a very crude, very, very crude bound. Because, for instance, we bounded all these objects with their maximum value. So there are situations where this bound would be very loose. Let me give you an example. An example is, imagine that I have my Hamiltonian, like in the Ising model, is the sum of two types of terms. T1 and T2, okay? And all the T1s commute with each other, and all the T2s commute with each other, and they come with couplings H1 and H2. And let's say that H2 is much larger than H1. Okay. So in fact, the model with emergent light has this structure. And the speed of the photons in that model is given. So actually, so this is Hamiltonian, right? So it should mimic the Hamiltonian of electromagnetism, right? So what should these two couplings, what should they be? Epsilon and 1 over mu, right? And the speed of light should be 1 over the square root of epsilon times mu. Sorry, so one is 1 over epsilon, and the other one is 1 over mu. So this is what it should be. What I'm saying is that T1 and T2 are somehow E square and B square, the density of the electric field and magnetic field. You can actually do it in a spin system, not spins 1 half, spin at I with large spin. OK. So this should be more or less the speed of light. However, if you do the Lib-Robinson bounds, then you, to bound the things, you will pick H2 that bounds everything. And then, as you can see, the velocity is proportional to this coupling. So you would have a maximum speed of signals that goes like H2, which is much larger than the speed of light. So you see, this is an upper bound. The problem with an upper bound is that it could be loose. That you say, there is nothing larger than that. But that doesn't mean maybe it's loose. Maybe you have a tighter upper bound, which we would like to be this. OK, so in order to accommodate this, this proof is not OK. You need some modification. So that's why I'm saying there are many, many Lib-Robinson bounds. So with some modification, people can indeed obtain this. oh, and then it's very nice, because actually shows you that in this model, there is no interaction that goes at this speed. The maximum is the speed of light. And maybe you can understand, so, why? Because, so think of the Ising model, right? We have the ZZ terms and the X terms. If we only had the ZZ terms, they would all commute with each other. And in this game of commuting, actually of non-commuting, there would be no propagation. So you need two terms that do not commute in order to propagate a signal or information or whatever it is. So the ZZ terms will not commute with the X term, and then the next ZZ term will not commute with the X term. And this reminds you what happens in the electromagnets, right? You have, this is the circuitation of a field. The electric field changes, and therefore there is a change in the magnetic field, which implies there is a change in the electric field, that means a change in the magnetic field. Now, when you count these paths, each path is made of alternating fields. So you can actually repeat this proof and remember that they are always alternating. So you can bound all the white ones with H1 and all the red ones with H2. And so when you put them all together, so there are H1 to the n over 2 times H2 to the n over 2, which gives you the square root of H1, H2 to the n. And in the end, then this n goes into the Liber-Robinson bound. So the speed is square root of H1, H2. So that's the logic. Another comment is, does it work on some infinite dimensional Hilbert space? Okay, now this is harder, right? Because now these operators are not bounded anymore. So it seems desperate because everything seems to go to rot. However, okay, so this is a bit more sophisticated. However, so think of the harmonic oscillator, okay? The Hamiltonian or the harmonic oscillator is not upper bounded. You, in principle, can have energies. You know, there is no limit in how much you can excite the harmonic oscillator. But every time I have a transition in the harmonic oscillator, can this transition be infinite? Imagine this harmonic oscillator is an optical cavity and I get a photon out of it. Can I get a photon at infinite energy?
Yes.
No.
By not?
No. There is, if there is one thing in physics, is that all physical quantities are finite. If all the quantities that you can measure are finite.
Yes, but we can have arbitrarily high energy.
You could have, yeah, sure, you could have an arbitrary large, but it is always finite.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So now the point is, local interactions should always be finite. Otherwise, the energy density in a point would explode. So this, in other words, you could have operators that are not upper bounded, but you just cannot populate all the levels. And even if they are very populated, the important thing maybe is that when you exchange energy, this exchange of energy is finite. So it would be maybe the phi are not upper bounded, but these objects are upper bounded. Okay? So when they exchange energy, when they do not commute, that is upper bound. So it would be nice to reformulate the theorem in a way I told you, in a way that does not contain other than commutators. So it actually can be done, only we have to do, instead of taking the first derivative, we have to integrate the second order differential equation. You take two derivatives, you cast everything in terms of commutators, double commutators, whatever it is. So you would not, because we have terms that have this structure. If you take the second derivative, you would have things that have this structure. So they only contain commutators. So I only need to bound this. Now, of course, the proof becomes hairy, but can be done. All right, so since we are not having a break, let me finish by showing you the non-signaling thing. Okay. So I want to show you that if we have our Lib-Robinson bounds that are written up, they disappeared. Okay, I will write them when I need them. And okay, so now again, I have A and B. Let me call C everything else. Our Hilbert space is therefore HA tensor HB tensor HC. Do we agree so far? Okay. So let's try to understand what it means to send a signal. So we have an initial state of our system. Let me call it rho zero. Question, where does our state live? In what Hilbert space?
Bounded.
This one. So this is a state on A, B, C. Okay? Good. Now, let's say that I do something on this state at the location A, is when the signal starts. Okay, so what I'm doing is that I take some, let's say, for instance, it's a unitary operation. I just rotate my state a little bit. So I have a UK, UK dagger, but it is at the site A. Of course, here I should put the identity on B and C. But in the following, I will drop it, okay? I will drop the identity. You understand what I mean. Okay, so now I have created a signal, okay? So this is what I call rho k on ABC. K is labeling what signal I'm sending. So for instance, k equals 0 means that UA of 0 is the identity on A. So I'm not sending signals, right? Because I could do that. I don't send signals. Okay, at this point, there is some Hamiltonian, right? So you have some Hamiltonian that defines the time evolution. And time evolution is given by some U operator, that is the exponentiation of this Hamiltonian. And it's an operator on A, B, C. Okay. So the time evolved state after I send the signal is UABC, rho k ABC, U dagger ABC. Okay. So now, where does this state live? Everywhere. But now I'm here, I'm collecting the signals. So if I'm making only experiments on B, can I use this state? Well, I should trace out to the rest, right? I should trace out A and C. So this is what I will call sigma on B at the time t carrying the signal k. Okay. So how do I look at this signal? I measure some operator OB. So measuring means I take the trace of OB with sigma k bt. Now, if I see some expectation value, doesn't mean that it is a signal. Not necessarily, because I could measure something even if I do nothing, right? Even if I do not see nothing, so when k is equal to zero, then OB sigma zero would have a non-vanishing expectation value. Okay, but this is easily cured. I take the difference between these two objects. This also depends on time. And take the absolute value. If I took the most discriminating measurement, this would be the trace distance between this state and this state, right? Remember what we were saying. Okay. So this is the object that we want to evaluate. Okay, now there is some tedious, it is 6 or 7 lines of algebraic manipulation. Try to do it as a problem. The students are taking part 2, will have it in their problems. One can show that this is equal to the absolute value of trace of rho 0 ABC, UK dagger A, UK A OBT. It's actually not very big deal, this manipulation. Okay, so this is what we, this is our signal. But now you see that this object must, it's the trace of some operator in a state. So it's upper bounded by the norm of that operator. But it's the expectation value of some operator. The expectation value of an operator cannot be larger than the highest, largest of its eigenvalues, which is the norm of that operator. So this is upper bounded by the norm of this operator. But the norm of this operator is equal to the norm of just this, right? Because this is a unitary operator. So this is upper bounded by the norm of UAK OBT. Oh, there you go. This is our operation at A, commuted with B depending on time. I've just switched what are A and B. Now you see why it appears. And now this goes like 2 OB, because the norm of UA is 1, e to the VT minus D between A and B. So you see no signaling, because the signaling, which is this, is upper bounded by this.
Yeah. This do we make the assumption that like rho zero could be a state entangled in A and B?
So any state. In fact, but this is a great comment, because since we didn't do this assumption, and this could be entangled, this shows you that even if you use entangled states, you cannot send a signal. In fact, entanglement doesn't violate causality. And there is nothing spooky about entanglement. But this has to do with the theological questions that we already faced. Okay, I have 5 minutes more, so let me show you.
Actually, Alyosha, we're all 10 minutes over.
Ah, yeah?
Yeah, the students have a tutorial actually in like 2 minutes, so we should probably stop.
Okay, so I'll continue tomorrow. Thank you.